There are quite a few faces that I don't recognise, so can I say, if you haven't been to one of our meetings before, welcome to Sheffield Humanist Society. If you have, and I don't recognise you, I'm so sorry about that. I'm Mike Granville, the secretary, and I'm also the speaker this evening. This is my, what you might call my specialist subjects. There will be some announcements at the end about next month's meeting, and don't make a dash for the door because I need to catch up with you and ask for contributions to the cost of our room. That's okay there then, Chris, is it? Okay, fine. Right. I was listening to PM programme this evening, and there was a brief item there where they were interviewing Opus Dei in London today, who are getting very anxious about the reception that the Pope is going to receive when he gets here, and in a negative way. They're quite concerned about it. And so over the next couple of weeks, you can expect to see a concerted effort by Opus Dei putting out all kinds of favourable stuff about the visit and about everything. They've realised that it's a little bit late to be doing that. But any Opus Dei members? Well, you don't know. I just thought I'd ask. I feel, because of the nature of this talk and some of the content, I think I should set out my own position and background. I refuse to be described as a lapsed Catholic. I'm an ex-Catholic. I thought about it, walked away, and I've now reached the point where not only does it make me angry to look back at the church from outside, but even now some of the stuff that they say and think makes me laugh. When you do that, you know you're an ex, and I don't have any Catholic guilt. I am delighted to be doing this. I look on it as a labour of love. I went right through the whole thing, educated by nuns in primary school, De La Salle brothers in secondary school. I was frequently strapped, but not abused. It would be difficult, really, to overstate how deeply I was indoctrinated in the church. Our house belonged to the church. We lived across the road from the priests. The church was next door to that. The church social club was next door to our house. It was as close as that. The convent was along the road. The school was around the corner. You know, couldn't get much closer. And if things had followed the course that they were going to follow, I would have become a priest. That's what I was going to do. I changed my mind at age 16. Hang on. But two of my older first cousins did become priests, one in a Benedictine order and one not. The reason I left the church was because I simply, I did what you're not supposed to do in the Catholic Church, which is stop and say, hang on a minute, how does that work? What exactly is this all about? If that's so, how can that be so? You're not supposed to do that. And I did, and I thought a great deal about what I'd been taught and what I would therefore tell my children. That was the point at which this started to come apart. I knew the answers that I should be giving to those questions, but I wasn't prepared to tell them to my children. I didn't believe them, and I wasn't prepared to pass them on. And at that point, really, we parted company. And the whole, as I put it, the whole edifice of the dogma for me fell apart at that time. But this is not about what Catholics believe. It's not about doctrine and dogma. You know, I can talk to you about that if you like. I can answer you if you want to know what exactly is the Immaculate Conception. I can tell you. But that's not what this is about today. And it's not about individual Catholics. And I know individual Catholics who live good lives. It's about the church as an organization and its history of truly appalling acts, and in particular about its ability to emerge, seemingly unscathed from these episodes over a very long period of time, to rationalize these acts, to justify any course of action if it promotes the furtherance of the church and of its objectives. And I, when people refer to organized religion, people particularly who are not churchgoers, and they say, well, you know, I'm not keen on organized religion, I always take it that this is the kind of thing that they mean. I want to cover recent events, really. It's the most recent history that I think we have to be concentrating on. To look back into the 20th century, a little bit before that, but not much. And the reason why that question, how do they keep getting away with it, appeared in our flyers, was because that actually, the thought just came to me while I was sitting, once again, boggle-eyed at some of the things that I was learning that I had not come across before. A lot of it I did know. But I've learned stuff this time round that I did not know before in digging deeper. And so that was why I persuaded Dave Jeffries to include that question on our flyer. And one or two people have, I think, was it the Telegraph said they weren't entirely happy about that wording, and he had to soften it a bit. There are one or two places where you won't have seen that question. The library, I think, we're not happy with distributing that wording. Please don't think that I have an answer to this question. How do they keep getting away with it? I have some thoughts on the subject, but really, they don't go much beyond thinking that this is a mix of deference. Well, you know, these people are very senior in their organisation. On the part of governments in particular, who are always worried about voters. There are no voters, really. There are no votes, really, in knocking the Pope or knocking any religious leader. It's going to cost you votes, so don't do it. There's nothing to lose by saying, well, what a great bloke. What a lovely fella. I think maybe there are still people who have a fear of blasphemy. You know, you just don't do that. You don't criticise people like that. And reluctant to criticise what they still see as in some way sacred. There may be other thoughts, and I would be very happy to hear your views. But it's especially perplexing to see this continuing reverence and deference in these days, in where we see a continuing decline in church attendance among Catholics, that is, I'm talking about particularly now, combined with their apparent reluctance to embrace the rules which govern their faith. You may have seen a lengthy piece in The Observer on Sunday, he was talking, a Catholic writer, by the way, one Peter Stanford, saying the beleaguered Catholic Church struggles against secular tide. And, you know, he's appalled that people have the effrontery to attack the Church and the Pope. Within it, he mentions recent figures by Ipsos Mori, which suggests that of the Catholic population of a little over 4 million, that's people saying, yes, I'm a Catholic, something like 1 in 5 observe the requirement to attend Mass on Sunday. Now, you might think, well, that's not bad. In the Catholic Church, it is. It's very bad. You have to understand, if there are any ex-Catholics, right, so you know that if you don't go to Mass on a Sunday, it's not, well, you know, try next Sunday. It's a mortal sin. You have to go to confession. If you die in a state of mortal sin, you go to hell. It really is that simple. And I don't think they changed it from anything that I've read recently. You die in a state of mortal sin, you go to hell. Not going to Mass on a Sunday is a mortal sin. A Catholic once tried to persuade me recently that going to Mass on the internet counts, but I'm pretty sure it doesn't. So, what's going on within the Catholic Church, within its own membership, that they are... I think there's almost an embarrassment amongst many of them about belonging to this organisation. matters of church teaching that are largely ignored. I mean, you don't need really to do great detailed studies to know that the church's instructions on family planning are widely ignored. They must be. Otherwise, there are an awful lot of people practicing a huge amount of restraint. And the acceptance of dogma. And I'm sure that if I got, you know, if I could get a Catholic in a corner and went through some of the dogma and doctrine and said, do you actually believe that happened and that this, I think you might look at little looks of doubt, but they don't have that the impetus just to say, no, I don't, stuff it, I'm off out of here. Don't do that. Their reluctance to sign up certainly applies in their response to requests to pay for this visit. The government has asked them to pay for only a small share of the costs, and it, from all the reports, it seems they're unable to do even that. They're not prepared to pay for the tickets for the various masses and other ceremonies where the Pope will be officiating. Tickets were sent out to the churches. Your parishioners will be queuing up for these at 25 quid a pop, and they're all being sent back in large batches to the diocese because nobody is taking them up. The government's put a cost of £20 million on this visit, and you might think, well, yeah, 3 days, I suppose, really. But actually, that's really just the cost that where they have to say this will be spent in a visible way. The invisible cost of policing and security will be far, far greater. And the NSS has estimated that it could well approach sort of 80 million, maybe even 100 million. There's no knowing because they won't tell anybody. They won't say what these costs are going to be. The NSS, you may be aware, has given notice of questions under the Freedom of Information Act for these costs to be disclosed at a later date. Whether they get anywhere with that, I rather doubt. So we're going to end up paying for a big chunk of that. But you won't feel it. I said that I wanted to concentrate on later stuff, so you know, I'm not looking at all the well-known stuff, the Crusades, the Church's activities in Central and South America, the Cathars, all that stuff, the Inquisition, even some of the stuff that went on in the Papal States before they were... They're easy targets, and I mean, if you were taking an empathetic view, hello, Frank. If you were taking an empathetic view for the Catholics, you might say, well, they would argue that these were of their time. They were of a time when brutality was more of a norm, and the Catholic Church just picked up at that. What I would like to do this evening is look at the later times that we might think society was more enlightened. 19th century, maybe. Slavery was being abolished. Education was spreading. There was a growth of ideas about reforming society, and there were increasing degrees of suffrage and democracy. And you can research and see that the Vatican was deeply unhappy about this. Deeply unhappy. 19th century, the middle of the 19th century, was the unification of the Italian state into the shape that we see it today. And the Vatican was very unhappy about that because that was the point where they lost the last of their papal states, and they saw this movement to democracy as extremely retrograde. It might surprise you to find that the people who lived within the papal states had actually had no say in the running of them. I mean, you might think that doesn't sound likely, but that's the way it worked. And to add to their indignity, the Pope at the time was kicked out of Rome and needed to raise some money to come back, and raised it from a banker by the name of Rothschild, who was, of course, Jewish. There's a substantial irony to that because there's another continuing theme running through everything that they do from the 19th and well into the 20th century, and that is anti-Semitic. You don't have to scrape below much below the surface to find anti-Semitism. And that comes, that brings us to the first incident that I would like to tell you about, which really, for me, typifies this mental state. You have to visualize a mental state where you can do what you think is right, and it doesn't matter what it seems like to anybody else. And this is very well documented because it went all around the world. By the middle of the 19th century, items were being reported around the world. There was a Jewish child living in Rome in the year 1858 by the name of Edgardo Mortara. This was in the reign of Pius IX, Pio Nono, as he was called. And Pius discovered that this child at age six had been taken from his family by church officials because they discovered that this Jewish family that he came from had employed a Christian servant, and when the child was born, he was very ill. Now, there is an arrangement within the Catholic Church. If you have a child which is born and is perceived as close to death, anybody can baptize it, because otherwise it goes to limbo. I mean, a lot of blank looks. Nobody has any idea what I'm talking about here, unless you've come through it. Right, you've got to get the child baptized. If you get the child baptized and it dies, it goes straight to heaven, you see. So the Christian servant baptized the child. Years later, the church officials discovered that the child was baptized and said it therefore cannot be raised as a Jewish child. It is a Catholic child. You can't unbaptize it. And people appealed to the family appealed to the Pope and said, this is our six-year-old child. He refused to allow it to rejoin the family. He brought the child up in the Vatican. For all practical purposes, you could say he adopted it. And would you believe the boy went on to become a Catholic priest? Now, that's not something where you go to one source and you think, what an interesting story. The New York Times ran 20 editorials on this subject, outraged at what was going on. But that was the kind of thing that they felt able to do. And I'm not sure they've entirely grown out of it. So, moving on, 20th century. I'm going to move swiftly through these because I did mention some of them in a previous talk last year. The Pope, Pope Pius XI by this time, in the 20s and 30s, signed treaties, first with Mussolini in 1929 and then with Hitler in 1933. The Lateran Treaty in 1929 came with very favourable terms for the Church. Bear in mind, Mussolini was an avowed lifelong atheist. That nothing was flaunted his atheism. But, of course, he needed the support of the Church. And a treaty was arranged whereby, with his rise to power, the Church would step aside, and in return, he gave them, first of all, a large sum of money, some of which was directly for the Pope's personal use in his household. But also, most important, and this connects with this month, recreated the Vatican as a sovereign state. Because at that time, from the 19th into the 20th century, it was just a part of Italy and was feeling the rough end of that. So the sovereign status of the Vatican dates only from 1929, thanks to Mussolini. They said thank you very much and really never looked back. Money started to flow in. They were hard up at the time. Money started to flow in. And the Catholic Church disbanded any movement that opposed Mussolini in Italy. Something very similar in Germany, where the papal nuncio or ambassador was somebody called Eugenio Pacelli, and he later became Pope. But he was in Germany and negotiated a treaty with Hitler, in which again money changed hands. But most importantly, Hitler agreed that he would not harm the Catholic Church on condition that the Catholic Church did and said nothing to oppose his objectives. And as I said, that one in particular was coordinated by Pacelli. And in 1939, when the reigning Pope, Pope Pius XI, was beginning to think, I may have got this a bit wrong. Hitler is really not a good guy. Right on cue, he died. And Pacelli was elected Pope, and he was the Pope right through the war. And there is really no question, if you read the records, even reading the minutes of Hitler's cabinet, where he pays tribute to the difference that it made to have this treaty, to know that the Catholic Church was not going to oppose him. And so they were silent throughout the war in Germany. No active involvement in Nazi activities. They weren't allowed actively and openly to take part in Nazi activities. But I mentioned earlier the matter of individual Catholics, and I think it's worth noting that there are many cases where individual Catholics acted in support of the Jews and to oppose Nazism. But I mean, in many cases, they were simply executed. So nothing said in Germany. In the Balkans, there was a great deal said. Enforced conversion of Orthodox Christians. The headman in Croatia was somebody called Stepinac, the local bishop and archbishop, later made cardinal by Pius XII. And he was active in installing a provisional government in Croatia based on a movement called the Ustashi, who linked with the Nazis and simply cut great bloody swathes through the whole of that area, killing off anybody who opposed the Nazis. There was, without any question, enforced conversion of Orthodox Christians in that area to Rome. And there are some extraordinary quotes from the Vatican, from various people by name, about the horror with which they viewed Orthodox Christianity. And you think, they're only different from you by about that much. But you see, they were heretical. Heresy is just beyond the pale. There are too many examples of this, really, to go beyond just one, when a great many Orthodox Christians were herded into a church, and the Nazi officer in charge asked if any of them had converted, because if they had converted, they would have the appropriate papers. Two of them had converted and were sent off out outside the church, and they simply set about slaughtering all the rest of them, all the Orthodox Christians. And it's an extremely bloody chapter. Now, Stepinac, at the start, there's no question that he was involved with getting this underway in Croatia. There are a growing number of sources that say he changed his mind and eventually opposed them. And so I'm taking a neutral view on it. He might later have changed his mind. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. But Tito had no doubt, he locked him up. As soon as Tito came to power after the war, he locked Stepinac up, charged with war crimes. And Pius XII made him a cardinal, I believe, while he was still in prison. And he was later beatified, which is, I think, what they're going to be doing with Cardinal Newman later this month, which is the sort of halfway stage to becoming a saint. So that was Stepinac. And I remember as a child, in the 50s, Catholic papers were a feature of Sundays at home, and there was a constant publicity campaign about Stepinac, who was in prison with Tito, and another one called Minzenti, Cardinal or Bishop, and then Cardinal Minzenti, who was in prison in Hungary. He'd been imprisoned by the Russians, But he had no history of supporting the Nazis. But they made good victims, and of course, it was their anti-communism that really featured strongly. There was most certainly the participation of large numbers of priests in running the concentration camps in the Balkans, and for reasons which are not clear, one particular order, the Franciscans, are prominent in their activities. And there are many comments, including films and photographs of these priests against the Jews, the Roma, pretty well anybody, on behalf of the Germans. They were also active in running rat lines after the war, which enabled the Nazis to get out. That was partly in secret, and I spoke about that last year when I talked about somebody called Dragunovic, one of the Franciscan priests who organized rat lines out through Italy and to South America for the Nazis. What I didn't realize at that time, and it's one of the things I've discovered this time around, is that for several years after the war in Germany, the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, the bishops and senior people, and these are all openly declared by name, and they're on record with their diaries and letters and the rest of it, were pleading with the Allies on behalf of the Nazi war criminals. And this went on for some time after the war. The latest one that I've found, and I've not tracked it all the way through, was by 1948. This is more than 3 years after the end of the war. And it just seems extraordinary that in light of what they had witnessed during the previous, 10, 15 years, they felt able to stand up in support of these people and protest at the treatment they were getting. They were in the hierarchy of, for example, the Einsatzgruppen, who were the most brutal of the Nazis, putting people down, putting down Jews and the rest, were detained in a place called Landsberg Prison. And they were the source of constant protest from the German Catholic bishops, who thought that they should be better treated. They were arguing that they weren't war criminals, they were just prisoners of war. And these were people who were known to have committed appalling atrocities and were waiting to be tried. And one of these bishops, Bishop von Galen, and this is in his diary, which has been published, called for an end to the Nuremberg trials. He saw no reason for it. And he protested to the Allied powers. And that is a matter of record. And they were still at this 4 or 5 years later. One of the things that I found in reading about that was a quote from Adenauer. And if you're around in the 40s, you'll remember Adenauer. Not many of you would have been. There's Adenauer. Come here, Adenauer. There he is. Adenauer was the political leader in Germany after the war, and was largely responsible for the reemergence of Germany after being so badly smashed up. And he said, "I believe that if the bishops all together had publicly taken a stance from the pulpit, a lot could have been avoided." This was him looking back to the war years. "That didn't happen, and there is no excuse for this. If the bishops had been taken to the concentration camps or to jail, it wouldn't have hurt anything. On the contrary," that was his response to what they were then doing in the post-war period. And we have ...1948... German bishops sent a joint memorandum to the highest ranking US officer in Germany, General Lucius D. Clay, maintaining that the trials of German war criminals lacked both moral and legal foundation. And the writer of this book says, was it stupidity or simple callousness that led the bishops to write this memorandum, the main argument of which was the bishop's assertion that Germans should not be tried under laws hitherto unknown in Germany? That's a quote from them. And there's an element, isn't there, a familiar element of what planet are they on? They don't get it. They don't really get what's happened here and how they should be responding. And there's masses of such stuff coming from Germany. But when I said this thought had come into my mind, how did they get away with it? I was thinking, why was there no outcry, a general outcry after the war, about the silent assent of the Vatican in Europe, and indeed about its active participation in the Balkans? Well, you could argue that in the Balkans, of course, it shut down after the war because Tito was part of the Warsaw Pact, and so information wasn't coming out. That may be why it's only recently that people in the United States are suing the Franciscan Order for the loss of their family valuables. But in the rest of Europe, where things were in turmoil, but there were attempts to restore some kind of order. I don't remember much before about 1950, but what I do remember is that there was this overwhelming feeling of anti-communism. The great fear in everybody's mind was the communists. You may know of the German blockade when Russia would not allow supplies into Western Germany, West Berlin, which was occupied by the Allies. It was a rather strange business of the Russians having come further west than Berlin, but half of Berlin was occupied by the Allies, and they had a corridor, and the Russians shut it. So we flew stuff in to keep Berlin going, the Americans and the British, and the Allies. There was a great fear of the Russians. I mean, we used to hear things about, if you see soldiers marching through the city with snow on their boots, you'll know the Russians have arrived. They were really seen as at the gates. The next thing was they were going to sweep across through Western Europe. Little did we know they weren't really equipped to do that. But there was this anti-communist mania, and even if you weren't aware of that, you will know about people like McCarthy. In the United States, this if it was a mania, then over there it really did take hold. J. Edgar Hoover, too, with the FBI, his preoccupation at the cost of dealing with organized crime was anti-communism. They were obsessed with opposing the communists. And if you remember that the Vatican, as its dominant theme over the last century or century and a half, has been anti-communist, that would tend to bring them into the fold, so to speak, and would maybe mean that people wouldn't be taking issue with them over the things that they'd been getting up to and say, well, we welcome your anti-communism, but we do need to talk to you about a few things that have been going on as well. And the phrase that I used in that talk last year was, you'll be familiar with the expression, my enemy's enemy is my friend. Well, it's one thing to say that the communists are your enemy. Well, that's okay. We know what we're dealing with. But if your enemy's enemy is the Nazis, you really need to be very careful before you strike up an alliance with them. And that is what the Vatican did, without a shadow of a doubt, in Germany and in the Balkans. Hand in glove with the Nazis. And so there's my reference to things like the Crusades and the rest of it, and they were of their time. This was not of that time. This was in the middle of the 20th century, and there is no excuse for it. You won't see any kind of apologia for that. There are some attempts to rewrite history, that's all. Much of it is really too clearly written, and they just ignore it. They hope people will just take no notice of it. Move on to another subject. Looking back, I mean, it's fairly clear that a theme going back much longer than anti-communism, as far as the Catholic Church is concerned, is sex. 2,000 years obsession with sex. Last autumn, I went to the Intelligence Squared debate in London, where the subject was the Catholic Church is a force for good in the world. Well, this ought to be interesting. Proposing were Anne Widdecombe and an African archbishop. Opposing were Christopher Hitchens and Stephen Fry. And it was a massacre almost at the point of blood sport. I began to feel sorry for Anne Widdecombe and for an African archbishop. They wiped the floor with them. But Anne Widdecombe came out with this statement, which just, well, lots of times she said things that made people laugh, but this one in particular was, you tell us we're obsessed with sex, but we're not. Not yours, other people's. It's not their own sexual activity that we accuse them of being obsessed with. It's what do other people get up to? And you think, why? Well, there you go. There's a long history of it. And that took me back to an old friend of mine, the Catechism. I learnt this when I was in school, and it's really quite alarming how much of it comes back. I know question one is, who made you? God made me. Why did God make you? God made me to know him, love him, and serve him in this life, and to be happy with him forever in the next. Anybody else? Anybody remember question three? It never occurred to me at the time, with this malicious little document, this is a recent copy of it, by the way, that I remember thinking, you have to get to question number 300. Here we are, 339, before you get anything that resembles any kind of view of modern morality as we would see it, when it's to do with love one another. That's question number 339. Up until that time, we're talking about worshipping God, don't do sin, you'll go to hell, all that kind of thing. But the questions that came to mind, and I've transcribed them to here, I still remember these. Question 348. Which are the enemies we must fight against all the days of our life? And I used to recite this. I didn't need to read it then. The enemies which we must fight against all the days of our life are the devil, the world, and the flesh. Now, this is primary school. By secondary school, we'd moved on from that. What do you mean by the devil? He said, what do you mean by the world? What do you mean by the flesh? Now, this is primary school children. I didn't know what the flesh was. By the flesh, I mean our own corrupt inclinations and passions, which are the most dangerous of all our enemies. That's the church's teaching from age 4 onwards, and we would sit and learn and recite this, and you would be tested on your recollection of it. And that's the wording that you get in there for children. And so their obsession with sex runs really a very difficult parallel with the history of abuse, which goes back a very long way, in spite of the church's attempt to say this is the product of, depending on which quote you hear, it's the product of being tolerant with homosexuality. It's the product of the 60s and the product of sexual liberation that came from the 60s. No, it isn't. It goes back a lot further than that. I'm not going to go into a huge amount of detail about that in general purposes, but I mean, for example, here's a chap whose name you might know. He's on the most wanted list. Cardinal Bernard Law. Anybody know who he is? The Cardinal of Boston. The Boston Globe set itself, and this is an account of their reporting of what went on in Boston, which is one of the worst examples. They described it as putting a match to some very dry tinder. And the numbers of cases in Boston were huge. And he's a cardinal, was guilty of covering up. Eventually, the complex of buildings, which included his mansion, where there were other people lived as well, and where they had a training school and a seminary, had to be sold for $107 million a few years ago to pay some of the compensation that they're stuck with. But that's Cardinal Bernard Law. If you want to see him now, you don't go to Boston, you have to go to the Vatican. Because when they issued a warrant for him to appear in court, a subpoena, I should say, not a warrant, a subpoena for him to appear in court, he did a runner, and he's holed up in the Vatican and refuses to come out. The Vatican does not have an extradition treaty with the United States, so my prediction is he will die there. And I do wonder what will happen if the Pope does an official visit to the United States, because people are going to be waving that picture and saying, do you know where this guy is? That's Bernard Law. The number of cases in the United States is simply mind-boggling, and the amount of money that they've paid out. Simply mind-boggling. An estimate up to 2002 was that it was then exceeding $1 billion. $1 billion. Ireland. This has been really quite interesting, because in the middle of last year and then in the beginning of this year, I was in Ireland for family weddings. And so I got some of this full on. You may have been aware of two reports that came out, commissioned by the Irish government. In the middle of last year, the Ryan report looked at abuse across Ireland and what had been done about it. Towards the end of the year, there was something called the Murphy report, which looked at the Dublin Archdiocese in particular, where there had been a large concentration of abuse and cover-up. The astonishing thing about that was not just what the priests and then the church hierarchy had done. The extraordinary thing was the insight that it gave into the power, the way the church had exercised power right through Irish society. To the extent that there was a case reported in the Irish Times when I was there of somebody who had gone to the police with the details of an offence, with allegations against a priest, and had been told by the police, the correct people to deal with this are the bishop. You must take this to the bishop. That was where you were if you were an abused person in Ireland. Anyway, it all came out. You may have heard something of a letter that Benedict wrote to the Irish bishops. It was hopelessly inadequate, although it went into great length. I think they hope that people won't finish reading these things, but I did. It was hopelessly inadequate, and it was concerned mainly with the fact that what these people had done was sinful and that they should be asking God for forgiveness. And you think, well, you still don't get it. You know, it's the 21st century and you still don't get it. You may have seen something recently, an Irish lady in her 80s, whose son is a monk, has called for a one-day boycott of all matters Catholic in Ireland, in protest, in this case, against the church's misogyny. It's a theme I'm not particularly touching on today, but there you go, there's another one. So abuse is very widespread, but I need to bring a personal perspective to it. I was not abused, but my hometown in Cardiff had an archbishop in the 90s, in the end of the 20th century, called John Ward. And he was the subject of a Panorama special in the year 2000. And it was really a very odd experience, because I was away from home, I was travelling, I was stuck in a hotel room, and I got a phone call from my sister saying, whatever you're doing, don't miss Panorama. She'd phoned home, and my wife had said, well, no, he's somewhere, call him on the mobile. Watch Panorama. So I did. And I watched all of this unfold, and I wasn't aware of it. And I heard the story of two priests, one John Lloyd and one Joseph Jordan. Ward had received a personal letter from Bishop Budd in Portsmouth, warning him about Jordan, that he was seeking the priesthood and was not suitable. He was very suspicious of this man. This is Joseph Jordan. Jordan had a dubious history, including leaving a school in Doncaster under something of a shadow, allegations of abuse. But Ward went ahead and ordained Jordan against the advice of his priest secretary, Father Ambrose Walsh. And Father Ambrose Walsh was interviewed on this as well. During the program, it emerged that Father Ambrose Walsh had resigned his secretaryship in protest at the bishop's refusal, first of all, to take his advice and then to do anything about Lloyd and Jordan. At one time, Jordan was seconded to a church called St. Mary's in Cardiff. That's where I was an altar boy for 10 years. And my family home was directly across the road. I do mean directly across the road. You sit in the front room, there's the priest's house. It was as close as that, and they were frequent visitors. And that I was an altar boy there. Somebody once asked me, what's the most dangerous thing you ever did in your life? And I said, 10 years as an altar boy in the Roman Catholic Church. But I got away with that. Father Ambrose Walsh, as I said, resigned from his secretaryship. Lloyd and Jordan are both now in prison. Ward continued on Panorama and elsewhere against a clamour for his resignation as Archbishop. You know, he continued to give lame excuses for his inaction. He refused to resign until the Pope called him to Rome and said, sign there. There emerged a separate allegation, which never came to anything, from many years before, by a woman against Ward, where she alleged a sexual assault with a crucifix, alleging that this took place in a London church. There was no prosecution, but this was a repeated allegation. So that case is about as personal as it's got. Someone very close to me was abused, but I was not. As I said, some of these events took place in a house directly across the road from me. And I talked about being steeped in all of this. I mean, every member of my family took an active part in things. If the priests needed something doing, we did it. If they needed a room redecorating, we went and painted it out. And whatever. My mother cooked for them. She sewed for them. She mended their clothes. All that stuff. And it was still happening when I left there to move to London. I should add that Father Ambrose Walsh is one of my first cousins. And those... It broke him. The church says celibacy has nothing to do with any of this. And you can read pages and pages where they will argue this. If you were being cynical about it, and you look back to the church's decision, well, no, we think this is the way we're going to go. It means if you have a celibate priesthood, of course there are no families, and therefore there are no inheritances. Ergo, no loss of wealth from the church when priests retire and die. And you compare that with the Church of England, which has something of a problem with pensions and the rest of it, and you begin to see it actually makes quite good monetary sense. Whether it's behind any of this, I don't know. Your instinct would say yes. There are other people who will say it doesn't actually make any difference. There is a similar incidence amongst other groups of people who where there are similar situations with positions of trust and so on. Anyway, I touch on that only briefly. It's not possible to conclude it. Before we wrap up, really need to finish by nine. Something else that I discovered since last year's talk. Do tell me if you've ever heard of the concept of mental reservation. It's absolutely brilliant. A masterpiece of philosophy. When I was reading the Irish Times last autumn, in particular from the Murphy Report, the one about Dublin, the Church of the Religious Affairs reporter wrote about this, and it was the first time I'd heard it. He was talking to one of the archbishops, and he was asking, how is it that these questions have been asked, and they've been answered with untruth? Whether they'd paid compensation, and they would say no, when they had. And to my amazement, the archbishop introduced the reporter to the concept of mental reservation. Too dark to read from that one. And that was my first encounter with it. Lo and behold, during this early part of this year, I picked up a book from David's bookshop on Russell's Road. That's David Granville. He's no relation, but he's got a bookshop on Granville Road. By Joseph McCabe, an ex-priest, and mental reservation was in there, dating back to the 1940s. So when I came to do this, I thought, let's see what we can find about mental reservation. And here it is. The Catholic Doctrine on Lying, and you can find this in the Catholic Encyclopedia. Do Google that. There's a massive source of information about the Catholic Church and what they think. It's available on CD-ROM if you want to buy it, or you can just read it and print it. The Catholic Doctrine on Lying. Now, this goes back to the time of Augustine, when they started to say, no, you cannot lie. Telling a lie under any circumstances is a sin. A murderer comes to your door and says, is so-and-so and so-and-so here, and you're going to kill him, they're going to kill him. If you say, no, he's not here, that's a sin, that's a lie. That got a bit modified later on. And really, to cut a long and circuitous story short, what it amounts to is that if you mentally reserve some of the truth, it doesn't matter what you say. The example that Archbishop used to this reporter in the Irish Times and was quoted was to say, for example, you imagine the priest's house, and the parish priest is sitting there one day and he's working, and he sees a troublesome parishioner coming up the garden path, and he really doesn't want to see it. So he sends the curate to answer the door, and the curate answers the door. And the parishioner says, you know, is the parish, like to see the parish priest. Is he in? To which the curate says, no, he's not. Now, is the curate lying? I would say so. But he's not, you see, because he's mentally reserving the words to you. The parish priest is not in to you. I mean, it really is as simple and as crude as that. And you might think, no, that can't be right. But it is. That's what they say. Sorry about that. Must stop. I did say I wasn't going to get angry about this. Once you've created that brilliant concept, you can say anything. You can say and get away with anything until you really get caught out. But that's from the Archbishop's own lips and from the sources within the Catholic Encyclopedia. Mental reservation, do remember it. If you deploy it, don't tell anybody. I told you about it. So, and then they will argue that if this is to do with matters which are unfavourable to the church, well, then it is justified. The greater good is served. And you think, yes, but that's your version of the greater good. And of course, then you come back to, if it's harmful to the church, it's bad. If it's good for the church, it's good. And so if lying is good for the church, you lie. And the extraordinary thing really is that they are so confident in their righteousness that they feel able to explain this openly. The amazing thing was that this man said this to an Irish Times reporter, knowing it would be, that's the way this is, that's the way this works. So you can manipulate the truth. Anyway, it is no coincidence that we're doing this this month. Benedict arrives later this month. His own history, he has a history in the abuse scandal. He sent out directions to bishops concerning dealing with cases in secrecy. He personally ignored a case in the United States. He sent the letter to the bishops in Ireland. I think even they were embarrassed by the fact that it neglected really the real effects of the abuse that had been going on. It was more concerned, as I said, with the sin and the wickedness of what they had done and with asking God for forgiveness than with saying, I mean, really what the Irish people were looking for was for him to say, it's time to acknowledge that we have done appalling things, whether in the primary acts or in concealment. We should find ways to put this right by our public contrition and by asking each of these people to forgive us. We must stop lying about it. We must move away from our preoccupation with what's good for the church and consider what's best for the people that we have grievously harmed over many years. And he should be told also that as a consequence of his stupidity and stubbornness on the subject of condoms in Africa, the blood of millions of people, including children, is on the hands of the church as people lie dead and dying from AIDS. For your information, the Catholic Church's view on condoms is that they're a waste of time anyway, because the AIDS virus is much smaller than a spermatozoan and so can get through a condom, which is simply not true. For reasons best known to themselves, they haven't produced any scientific basis for that. But then, of course, they don't do science. They still think that respect comes as of right. And I think they're going to learn over this next month or so that respect is now something that has to be earned. It doesn't come with the hat. And the world won't show deference any longer, at least a lot of it won't. There will still be places where they will. No, this is not the Middle Ages, it's the 21st century. And things will never be the same again. And it's up to him to choose whether he changes this toxic organization and stops the influence that it has carrying out, and changes it into one that at least does no harm. Maybe even does some good. It has the power to do that, but it has to choose to do so. And I think that's the message that he should get when he comes here in 2 weeks, and to say, time to call it enough. Thank you. If anybody has observations, questions, contradictions, anybody saying, disagree, do speak up.
I was wondering what role the Catholic Church played in the Western countries during the Second World War, like in Britain and the US, and also what role the Catholic Church played in the First World War as well. And my question is, it's the support of the Catholic Church of Mussolini and Hitler. Was that really any different from the extent to which they were just supporting whatever elite was in power, wherever the church happened to be? I mean, isn't it in the nature of these hierarchical religious organisations that they pander to whoever's in power? Because, you know, that's...
I suppose, yes, you could say that there's a good case for saying that. But a lot of people have said that without the support of the Catholic Church in Germany, and they would have taken a serious hammering over it, make no mistake. But bear in mind that Bavaria, which was the origin of the Nazi movement, was the strongest of the Catholic areas. You know, it tends to be predominantly Catholic to the south. A lot of people have said without that support, Hitler would not have been able to carry out the final solution. And he said that in a cabinet meeting, that the final solution was possible because of this Concordat. Now, you might say, well, they didn't have a lot of choice in the matter. I think that's a fair question. I think it's a fair observation. A lot of individual Catholics in Germany didn't take that view. And I think it would be you could understand if they did, just kept their heads down. But I think really when organisations that take a moral lead, that claim to take a moral lead, first of all, you expect more from them at the time. And if they had said in 1945, we are really very sorry that we didn't do anything about this, we will now do our best to put this right, you might have said, well, all right, they were difficult times. But they didn't do that. They continued with the same campaign in arguing that these were not war criminals. So I think there was a bit more to it than just, we better keep our heads down and just keep stumm. I think there was more to it than that. There was a real sympathy, and it stemmed from their strong anti-communism. I've not seen anything at all to suggest that there was anything of the kind voiced here. I don't think they would have said anything here. I don't think they would have dared, even if they'd thought it, or in the United States. It was very much concentrated there.
On a similar thing, it occurs to me that Ireland, a historically Catholic country, was not involved in the war. I wonder if there's any connection there.
In Ireland, did you say?
It wasn't involved in the Second World War.
That's right. I've not seen anything at all to come from there. I haven't seen quotes or reports of anything elsewhere that would suggest that there was support for the Nazis on the grounds of their anti-communism elsewhere in the church. I think outside people just saw it as a potentially evil force. Matt, and I think there were, and then John was showing as well, Matt.
One place where in the early 20th century the Catholic Church did count out to the authority was in Spain, where the Catholic Church was deeply involved in Franco's attack on the constitutional and elected democratic government.
Yeah.
So the Catholic Church was, on occasion, well prepared to stick its neck out, take risks, but in this case it was again supporting a fascist, in this case not against communists, but against social democrats.
Against the Republican movement, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Who weren't even particularly atheistic, they were simply modern social democratic. Mm-hmm. On the issue of whether the church has learned from what's happened and intends to change its ways, it's notable that there has still not been a worldwide order being sent out by the Catholic Church saying to its cardinals and bishops, if you become aware of an abusive priest, tell the authorities.
Mm.
These have been very selectively doled out in areas like America,
yes.
Britain, where there have been big scandals among the states,
yes.
Not strong. There is still no worldwide order to say this. So for all the pretense for the church is concerned and sorry and has learnt, it's clear that the evidence is still intent everywhere they can to cover up, keep things secret.
You're right. There's a document dating from 1961 called Crimine Solicitationis, which sets out the procedures to be followed when cases are discovered, when allegations are made. It had to be translated out of the Latin, first of all, and an American Catholic chaplain did that. And I think it runs to about 17 pages, and there is not a single reference to civil authorities. It's all to do with how these cases are dealt with within the church. It talks about proper authority and so on. It's not talking about proper authority like as the rest of us would understand it. It's within the church. They seem to feel that they have the right to deal with that. Again, that's one. I don't think they've got that yet. They still resent. The example in Belgium this year, where the bishops resented the fact that the police raided a house. They thought it was outrageous. They were investigating crimes, and it was outrageous that the police should have raided this house. And that's still the mindset. This is our problem. This is our issue. We will deal with it. Well, no, it's not. It's a criminal offence. Why don't you get it? And there's this wonderful case this week, I think, also from Belgium, is it, where the boy had the audacity to take a little recording machine into him in with an interview with the cardinal, who was telling him how he was going to deal with the abuse by a bishop, and that, you know, paraphrasing, you know, I don't think it would be in your interest or the bishop's for you to do anything about this. And the boy took a recording in with it. It is now published. Mm-hmm. The recording's been published. And yes, it's still seen as their territory. It's their authority. And why would they have someone else? Other people don't understand this. This is the church. We investigated. And the pages of, I mean, the criminale solicitationis thing, it is tedious reading. And they never use two words when they can use 20. And it just goes on and on and on. And what they're saying essentially is, we deal with this in here. And then Benedict reinforced all of that principle by saying, you will keep secret about this. You will not disclose this. So, yes. Gordon.
With regard to the Catholic Church paying out to families,
yes,
where paedophilia has taken place to a member of the family, what examinations have taken place and in which countries whereby the Catholic Church have been forced to admit that they have made these families have a vow of silence on?
Well, they emerge in a trickle. There's the case. There was a case in Ireland where an archbishop during this year admitted that he had supervised a meeting where two boys, I think of about 8 and 9, were required to sign statements declaring that they would not tell anybody about this, and that was his way of dealing with it. And he I don't know how it came about, but he owned up and he said yes, he had done that and he was not proud of it. And then of course you had a whole bunch of the Irish bishops offered their resignations to the Pope, who said, no, you don't need to resign, it's all right, fellas, we'll deal with this. And they're still there, they're still in post. I mean, I'm not laughing because it's funny, but because it's just It's like reading some bizarre work of fiction at times.
Find out what the legal situation is. If you say that children of 8 and 9 sign something, I mean, that is no legality.
Well, the answer, Gordon, I think the civil authorities are still thinking, what the hell are we going to do about this? How are we going to deal with this on this scale? I would think in Ireland they're really very concerned that it will eventually bring the whole thing crashing down. An Irish politician has already suggested that the Catholic Church should now withdraw from education in Ireland. I mean, that caused a bit of an earthquake. I think it's still something they're coming to terms with. And I'm still waiting to see the first serious prosecution. There have been very few. The civil authorities do not seem to be falling over themselves to prosecute in these cases. I think they do it only when they have no choice. It's stuck in front of them and somebody says, what are you going to do about it? But take the case of Cormac Murphy O'Connor, recently retired Cardinal of Westminster, who admits that he moved a paedophile priest, Michael Hill. He knew what he had been doing. He doesn't deny it. And he moved Michael Hill to a chaplaincy of Gatwick Airport, which was in his diocese. This is before he became cardinal. And, of course, Michael Hill just made hay, didn't he? Because there was a continuous flow of families and children through Gatwick, and he was like a child in a sweet shop until he got caught. Cormac Murphy's O'Connor's excuse for that was, we did not understand the addictive nature of this behaviour. Okay? Hill had given him an assurance it wouldn't happen again, and he believed him. I mean, there is such mind-boggling incompetence that you wonder how they manage. Ward was doing the same thing. I did the best I could. I did the best I could in the circumstances. What else do I need? And Hill did get prosecuted. But as I understand the law, and I'm not a lawyer, but conspiring to conceal a crime, I think, is a criminal offence. Why has Cormac Murphy O'Connor not been in court, at least to answer in a preliminary way, the accusation that he concealed a crime? Conspiracy, or whatever it is. Instead, Gordon Brown was on the point of elevating him to the peerage last year. And I think somebody had a quiet word in his ear and said, I don't think that would be a good move.
To some extent, Mike, part of the 20th century's problem was that this kind of abuse and cover-up was going on in lots of institutions, like the military,
yes.
Like public schools.
Yes.
And
children's care homes.
Other religious,
yes.
Organisations.
Yes.
I was in education, and in my early years as a teacher, it happened.
Yes.
Teachers were moved.
Yes.
And it was kept quiet. It was dealt with within.
Mm.
And to some extent, they were part of the attitude of the whole society,
yes.
At that time. I mean, abuse and incest has been going on a long time in a lot of,
that's true.
Places.
Yes.
And it's a bit curious that the concentration has been, I'm not trying to defend them, on the Catholic Church, but I just wonder how much abuse goes on with people in authority in other religions.
I've seen reports that you would find comparable figures, whether that's to do with religious organisations or to do with organisations where there is this duty of care that puts them in a position of power, and they said you do find it. And I suppose you could expect that there are certain occupations where somebody with that kind of inclination will be drawn. But when you come to a religion, this is an organisation that sets itself as the source of morality, as the exemplar, and when they fail so catastrophically and dramatically, I think really it's viewed in a slightly different way. But I'm fairly sure you're right.
As do schools, of course. They set themselves up as a moral authority as well.
Well, that's,
and of course,
yes.
Everybody knows what goes on in a lot of public schools and has done for years, and that's still kept quiet.
Yeah.
Teachers are quietly moved.
Yes, the guy who wrote in, well, in some cases they're not even moved. Somebody said to me recently, there's a teacher still in a school, and in his day, and he says he's still there, in his day, one of the 14-year-olds got pregnant, and he stayed where he was. There you are. This guy writing in The Observer says something like 0.4% of Catholic priests. He doesn't quote his source, but he says that's what it is, which means, what is that? Is that four in every 1,000? So it means that, you know, one in every 250 has been the subject of an accusation. I don't have any comparisons for that, but he didn't use the word only. I think he carefully avoided using the word only 0.4%. But I mean, that's fair enough. But I think really the point is less. I think people's attention has shifted away from the crime to the institutional cover-up. It's the cover-up, the lying, and all the rest of it that has caught people's attention. Before I come back to Matt, there's some people who haven't spoken yet.
Do you think the Catholic Church could actually admit its mistakes and say, yes, we got it wrong, and still survive?
Yeah.
Because wouldn't then I mean, the pressure is building up and building up and building up, and they see, I think, their only defence is just sticking their finger in the dike, and if they take it out,
I think there's a lot behind that. Yes, they are suffering a real hemorrhaging in donations, and I think in the United States they said there has been something like a 10% fall in church attendance. But as I've said on many other occasions in other contexts, the Catholic Church plays a long game. It's been around for 2,000 years. It knows that if it just sticks to its guns and just gets by, eventually people will just get tired of hearing this. I know it sounds odd, but they will. And I think
so you've got to have a sort of, rather like the Taliban, you've got to have a grudging respect for them, really.
Well, I suppose, I suppose so. But what will happen over the next 10 years, I really don't know. I think a lot of it depends on the civil authorities and whether they say, okay, we're going after these people now, we want the names, we want the dates, we want the details, we want the evidence, and there's going to be a procession of them.
So it can only really be done by this constant pressure. It can't be done by appealing to their
because you see that immediately takes them back to what's good for the church. Owning up to this on a large scale in the detail is not going to be good for the church. They know that. Frank.
What I find galling about this is precisely what you said just now. The church is an institution which sets itself up as a moral authority, as an institution which is supposed to help people to act in a moral way. They disparage humanists, for example, on the grounds that we don't have any authority or basis for any moral positions that we put forward, that they have the authority to delineate morals and to support moral behaviour,
yes.
That they have a pastoral role in people's lives and so on. And as I say, what is galling, I think, is the contrast between that, this holier-than-thou and we are the authority position, and the way they operate as an institution. Effectively, I'm interested in what you were saying about the arrangements between Hitler and the papacy and Mussolini and the papacy, and also what you had to say about the cardinals and bishops who protested long after the war was over about the prosecution of Nazis for war crimes. And so as an institution, they act in no way differently from sovereign states. And that includes our own sovereign state, who pay no heed to morals whatsoever in formulating a foreign policy. A foreign policy is formulated on the basis of the greatest good for the state itself. And morals don't come into it. We did have, for a short while, one foreign minister who famously promulgated an ethical foreign policy.
Yes, what happened to him?
I mean, the idea of an ethical foreign policy was a total novelty. People pricked up their ears and what can possibly be ethical about a foreign... What's it got to do with ethics?
Yes.
And it's absolutely true. Foreign policies have absolutely nothing to do with ethics. Mm. They have everything to do with the preservation and the greater good of individual states in a kind of rat race with other states.
Yes.
That's all it's about. The interesting thing for me is that, as I said at the beginning, an organisation that sets itself up as a moral authority
in fact behaves absolutely no differently from other sovereign states and shows complete contempt for morals, and that then, of course, that extends downwards when it finds itself embroiled in scandals of one kind and another. The church itself must be preserved. It must defend itself by any means. Totally immoral means are included, from any sort of criticism which might undermine it and its influence and its continuing power in the world. And that's the aspect of the matter that really interests me.
Yes.
You mentioned the importance of the Mass earlier.
Yes. attending Mass on Sundays.
Attending the Mass.
Yes.
But in one respect, what the Mass does, it absolves people of their responsibilities. They can do whatever they like, but when they go to Mass, that's okay.
And confession, of course. Yeah.
And confession. Well, it does the same for the organisation as well. It absolves the organisation every day, so they can do what they like. They can say these things, they can get away with it, because they're absolved every day to this concept of the Mass.
Yeah. Yes, there are some wonderfully interesting concepts within the whole organisation.
Is the infallibility of the Pope still on the agenda?
Well, I mean, they say so. That only dates from the 19th century, of course. An earlier Pius, I think, was it 8 or somebody else? And he was pronouncing at the time on the Immaculate Conception. Maybe why it came to mind earlier. And thought, well, we might as well go the whole hog and declare that when we are making a statement, for anybody that wonders, what the hell is infallibility? It doesn't mean that everything he says is right. What it says is that when the Pope speaks on matters of doctrine and dogma to be held by the whole church, that comes out of there, he is infallible. He cannot make a mistake because, by definition, on those occasions, he is guided by God. It's as simple as that.
So is the Catholic Church not the prime example of a very old-fashioned institution? It came into power right after the fall of the Roman Empire, 1600 years ago.
Well, the Roman Empire said
it's a sort of totalitarian regime where obedience is of the utmost importance, and it's a top-down structure, non-democratic.
Of course, it's top-down. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
So you're not really, you know, thinking for yourself is secondary to obeying orders from the hierarchy.
Yes.
And that is something which is an anachronism today.
I think there is only one democratic mechanism within the whole of the Catholic Church, and that's when they elect the Pope. Everything else
which is extremely limited.
Everything else is directed. You're quite right.
It's one of the vows that you have to take as a, if you join an order, is an order of obedience.
Order of obedience, yes. That's right.
The vow of obedience.
Yes.
So
you're right. But yes, he declared in the 19th century that on matters of faith and morals, when he made this statement, as they say, ex cathedra, which means from the chair of Peter in that role, then by definition, the Pope is infallible because he speaks inspired by God. I think that somebody then said, well, hang on, what about all the previous declarations? And he said, this is brilliant, isn't it? They were infallible, but they didn't realise it at the time. It's good, isn't it?
Okay, thank you very much.
And they're very good at this. I mean, they've been around longer than any other organisation. They've learned how to do this. They've played a long game, and they've been very good at it. I mean, how long did it take him to apologise for Galileo? And that was a bit half-hearted. Yes, and then JP2 added a little bit to it, but he didn't say, my word, we really got that wrong and we were completely out of our depth. It wasn't that. That's not what he said. You read the apology and you think, where's the apology in this? All he's saying is, you know, Galileo got it right. But they also say, well, yes, but he was a bit arrogant about it. There you are. And it took 300 years, 300 to 400 years, yeah. Yes.
I know she didn't mention much about the personal history of the current Pope.
No.
I was wondering if this was on purpose to avoid any character assassination, because I hear that he was a member of Hitler Youth and things like this.
Well,
or I thought you'd gone with that.
Yeah, I find it hard, really, to point the finger at people who did that, who would have done that. What would I do? What would I have done? What would I have done in that circumstance? You know, you had to be seen to be rubbing along. I don't know how wholehearted he was about that, whether he accepted the philosophy. I think there were probably quite a lot of people that did that, and I don't know enough to be able to say he was first in the line. He was pushing the others out of the way to sign up. I don't know. I don't know that would have been true. It might be really quite different from the truth. Hitler Youth, by definition, he was a young man. As a young man, I was going to become a priest. What a dumb thing that would have been. And so he did a stupid thing, I think. I think the later stuff in Germany is yet to be explored fully, where there have been suggestions that he was doing cover-ups while he was still in Germany. I couldn't really bottom that out sufficiently to say, you know, he was at it there before he went to Rome. So that's why I didn't go too much into that. Matt again?
In relation to the point that you get paedophiles and war organisations and cover-ups and war organisations, certainly you'll get cover-ups on one or two levels, and there's any number of line managers you don't want to get, you know, directly responsible for that. But in the Catholic Church, this went absolutely to the top.
This is
like, you know, the Prime Minister being involved in covering up.
Yes.
There's a letter from the French Cardinal, from a Cardinal to a French bishop. This bishop had actually went to prison, was imprisoned for not reporting an abusive priest and covering up and re-signing him. And this Cardinal said in it, "Congratulations for standing behind the priest and not the one of the authorities. I am forwarding this letter to all the other Cardinals."
Mm.
Benedict, the current Pope, was on the list.
Yeah.
This was in early 2000s.
And again, you've got this. It's very. You know, it was very public too, wasn't it? It was made. So yes, he did that publicly.
This is the equivalent of like the secondary education writing to headmaster and congratulations for not reporting that paedophile teacher. There's definitely, as Corey said, I'm not aware of any other organisation where it's been an international one right to the top. In my school, my autograph teacher was accused of being a paedophile. Instantly he was suspended. That went to the authorities, and he killed himself in a short amount of time.
Mm.
There was no cover up and nothing there.
Mm.
This isn't a habitual thing. So I would say not only is the Catholic Church more hypocritical than perhaps the inner organisation.
Yes.
I'd say in this case it is kind of worse in actual behaviour as well.
Well, I tried to keep a lot of that impersonal and objective, but it really, when you're confronted with something as close to home as we were in Cardiff, it's quite difficult. And so yes, it's you get angry about it, and you say we're entitled to expect better. Yes, Mark.
Liberation theology in South America, is that something which has to be taken seriously as a counter-movement?
Well, they don't like it, do they? They don't like its flirtation with democracy and what they would see as dangerously...
And also it puts celibacy
into question. It raises questions about all of these things. I mean, people have asked me in other situations, do you think they will do away with the celibacy rule? Yeah, not really. No, I don't. Not for a very long time. It'll take a long time.
The celibacy only started in the late Middle Ages, isn't it?
It wasn't from
the... It had to do with the accumulation of...
Yes, I think. Yes, I think so. I think there is some evidence for that, but of course you can't know. They were digging up rationales for things on the basis of theology, and you think, how do you do that? So they might have created a theological view of it, and I've heard people argue from a purely theological point of view that the degree of learning, concentration, and devotion, prayer, and the rest of it requires no distraction, and a family would provide distraction. I just think it asks a lot.
It's also very unnatural.
I think it's dangerous.
Yes,
I think it is actively dangerous. But there are priests. Let's not deny that there are priests who live a good life within this lifestyle.
They've accepted their own choice.
Through their own choice, yes.
But not through obedience, not through impulse.
Well, I think partly it is through a combination of their own choice to obey. And if you removed all of the constraints, they would probably be quite enthusiastic in rejoining the normal lifestyle of the human race. But there is something within the doctrine of the church that makes them accept this teaching and say, you know, yes, I believe this so strongly that I will go along with it. I mean, for example, in London in the 1960s, I worked with a man who had left the priesthood. It wasn't a matter of dogma. He hadn't been kicked out. He had asked to leave. The reason he had asked to leave was that he had fallen in love with a parishioner. She was Spanish, I think, or Italian, and we met her. Delightful lady and a really, really nice man. He had no argument whatsoever with the church's doctrine. None at all. He had no argument with the church's requirement that he stick to his vows and stay celibate. When he fell in love with this woman and decided that they wanted to get married, he asked the church to release him from his vows, saying he found it difficult, he would not be able to maintain his vows. And until they did and released him and he was fully laicized, which I think is the term they use for return to the laity, they lived as a celibate couple. Because that was how strongly he accepted and believed the rightness of the vow that he had taken as celibacy. He accepted it as strongly as that. And he was an extremely intelligent and wholly good man. Mm. Say what you like about his lifestyle and what he believed, that was a good man. I don't claim to understand that.
Isn't there an increase of clergymen who are married? They have a special name in the Catholic Church. They're not priests. They're below the priests, but
I don't know.
They don't have to take the order of celibacy. I've seen it in Jamaica.
Oh, there are. Yes, there are. Well, De La Salle brothers, the De La Salle,
they're serving the mass and everything.
De La Salle brothers don't take a vow of celibacy.
Yeah,
they live a celibate life, but it's not a vow. They simply choose to live that way. And what was the other thing I was going to say? Something else. It'll come back to me. Yeah.
Just a couple of very quick points.
Yeah.
I actually worked with a guy who actually left the priesthood.
Yes.
Got married.
Yes.
Then got divorced. I don't know whether it's the same one. But on the thing on papal infallibility.
Yes.
The head of the Mormon Church has a golden telephone. Direct line. So I was wondering whether they may have had the golden BlackBerry or whatever. Sort of one step ahead. And there wasn't the point. I've totally forgotten that. So I'll just leave it at that.
The Pope doesn't need a telephone. You know, it's and what I was going to add was that there are many cases, and Claire Jenkins wrote a book about them, of women who've established long-term relationships with priests and in some cases had children, and the priest has carried on as a priest and has just lived two lives. Nobody has known about her, and it's that's an extraordinary book to read. She came to us to speak to us some years ago, and she described a case where a woman, you know, he had visited her at her home, gone and set about his priestly duties, and he didn't come back. And after a few days, she began to be concerned, and she then discovered that he had died. But of course, nobody knew anything about her, so there was no mechanism by which somebody would come and say, something you really you need to know something very bad or something, because nobody knew about her. And she attended his funeral, and she'd been his partner for many years in a stable, what you might call an otherwise stable relationship. There are children who have come from relationships of that kind. Claire
children
Jenkins wrote about them.
They were referred to as children of God.
Yes, the book is The Passion for Priests, and it's a very good read. It's extremely well researched and written, all with the cooperation of the people involved.
You don't think that there's any possibility of moving, I don't think there is actually, moving to the Greek situation where the bishops are celibate but the priests aren't necessary.
I can just see the scramble for promotion, can't you? I'm really going to go after this promotion to bishop.
You're not forbidden in the Greek church to be celibate if you're a priest. It's just you're not compelled to.
I think it's a mistake to look for logic in these things. Although I was talking to my friend John Spence, one of our members who's away at the moment, so can't be here. And I came out and said, when you read this stuff and you start to see the way it works, you see that there is their logic, and you see where the word theological comes from. You know, it's logic, but of a, you know, it's logic, but not as we know it. You know, and that's it. It's theologic, and so you have to learn how to read it and think. I see what they're trying to do, but this is got more holes in it than your average sieve, by any normal standards. Anybody else before we all rush to the bar?
Just one. Yeah. About Anglican priests who have left the Anglican church and largely over the ordination.
Over the women, yes.
Priests, and have been accepted. In fact, a bit of poaching really has been done.
I am totally bewildered by this.
And are they, I mean, I don't know what the circumstances are, whether they then take on the full responsibility of a Catholic priest with possibility of promotion to bishop.
Well, I don't know. I don't know of any cases, but my understanding when I was a boy was that if you had somebody who had been married and was widowed, and decided to join the priesthood, he could. And there was something about somebody who was still married. That may be just a bit of a conflation of two ideas. But there was something a little bit different about the way that worked.
I think it's just weird. If an Anglican clergyman who is married converts to Catholicism with a little bit of retraining,
yes,
he can be considered a priest.
I tell you the bit about that puzzles me. It's not the married, unmarried, the celibate, not celibate. The bit that bothers me is this. Are they standing here, in the Anglican Church, thinking, I'm not putting up with this women ordination thing, and I'm not putting up with this homosexuality either, any of that stuff. I'm off to Rome. I do not at the moment accept and believe transubstantiation, but I will then. I mean, that's the kind of thing that I would say to somebody. If you're going to make this move, do you already believe in transubstantiation, or will you change your mind about it then? If you already believe it, what are you doing here? The answer is, don't look for normal logic in these things. It does not apply. It simply doesn't apply. And it was weird questions like that. I mean, I used to ask these questions in school. I used to get some really serious looks. You know, but how does this work? What happens about that? What would happen if you took a consecrated host, which is by now the body and blood of Christ, and submitted it to chemical analysis? Well, that would be sacrilege, Granville. You can't do that. And they were Irish, by the way. They were. Never mind what the results would be. It would be a sacrilege. You can't do that. So it's irrelevant. But I always wondered, what would it come up with? Well, we know what it would come up with, of course.
So do they.
And then, for how long after you've swallowed a consecrated host does it remain the body and blood of Christ? I mean, once your body starts getting to work on it, What happens if you're sick?
They had a rule, didn't they? You weren't allowed to bite it. You had to swallow it.
That's right. Yes, you mustn't chew it. That's right. You mustn't chew it.
And one day the poor old cannon fell over, and all these pieces of bread went all over the altar, and of course nobody could pick them up except him, and he was unconscious.
I read one truly horrible account of something where you take these things to the extremes, and the priest had administered communion, and this little old sort of toothless lady came up and said she had father, what's the problem? Well, I took communion as usual, and then suddenly I realised, this may be apocryphal, by the way, I mean, there are no names here. I suddenly realised that I was taking in the whole body and blood of our Lord Jesus Christ. Yes, of course. Well, for the first time I thought about this, and I realised that, of course, it includes his genitals. And I couldn't help myself, Father. I had to spit it out. Well, where is it? And she said, well, it's in my prayer book, Father. And the priest's dilemma was, what do I do with this? Because, of course, when there are leftover hosts, the priest has to consume them. You can't just let them go off. And so, brave man, he took it and swallowed it. And that's true. Right. Is there anybody else with any questions, observations? Before we adjourn to the bar. Thank you for listening. Excuse me if I've ranted, but there you go. On the subject of next month, some of you may have been here when we had Professor Danny Dorling. Well, he's coming back next month. The subject at the beginning of the year was his specialism. He's a human geography professor across the road here. And within that, he has an area of mapping. And one of the projects that he's been embarking on is mapping world religions and religiosity. And Dave Jeffries has sent me a little note about this. The second edition of the Real World Atlas, of which he's one of three authors, is being published next month in October. There's a new set of maps on distributions of people around the world, and he will be explaining what this means and how it came about, where the data came from, and on religions, on human nature, on what is possible for people to achieve, and so on. And it will be illustrated, obviously, to encourage discussion. But I understand that there is some very interesting background information on how the information was gathered about religions in different parts of the world. So that promises to be a very very interesting one. And of course, we'll be back into term time now, so it might be standing room only. So I hope we'll see you again then. And thank you all for coming. Terry.
I just have a question. Some time ago, we had a comment that somebody was organising to find out how much of the National Health Service money went to provide for the chapel. Did they anything about that?
The NSS, well, they had to estimate, because they didn't get all the replies, but the NSS estimated that it was something like £14 million.